On Radio Jackie today, I am speaking to Sir Ed Davey, who is the leader of the Liberal Democrats and the MP for Kingston and Surbiton. To start off with, you recently had the Lib Dem Party's annual conference roundup. Tell us how it went.
Well, the Liberal Democrat Party conference this year was quite a celebration because we'd had our best election this July for over 100 years, winning 72 seats. And so obviously people were pretty happy. However, while it was exciting, there was also the responsibility we've now got, the responsibility to repay the trust that so many people have put in us, to work as local champions in our own constituencies, but also to keep campaigning on the issues we raised, particularly the health service and care, on the costs of living, on environmental issues like sewage. And so I was really keen to get over to the message to the party that we needed to repay the trust that people have put in us and campaign on those issues.
And how does that responsibility bear down on you? Are you ready to take it on?
We have to. The NHS is in crisis. The care system is possibly even in a more severe crisis. The last government left the economy in a complete mess and people are still suffering with the prices of everything. And energy bills going up, for example. And I'm afraid the new government has been quite disappointing in the fact that they've withdrawn winter fuel payments. And with energy bills going up over 10% this winter, that's going to really hurt millions of pensioners who are struggling. So we're campaigning against that. We think it's wrong to withdraw the winter fuel payments from pensioners. And that's an example of us continuing what we said in the election.
Now, your new front bench has been announced. Tell us about that.
Well, very exciting. I now have 71 colleagues to make sure we work as a great team. And it's already started off really well, if I'm honest with you. And it was great to be able to give people different jobs. I mean, locally, the new MP for Wimbledon, the Liberal Democrat MP, Paul Kohler, he's going to be speaking for us on transport, which is a massive issue for local people, problems with SWR and buses and so on. And so Paul, I think, will be a great champion for transport issues. Sarah Olney, I've asked her to be our cabinet office person. That means she's shadowing Pat McFadden. Now, people may not know who Pat McFadden is. He's very, very senior in the Labour government. And I want to make sure that we're watching his every move and keep it, holding him to account. Munira Wilson Twickenham, she's doing education. She did it brilliantly before. And so many issues for our schools and our colleges and universities and our nurseries as well. Luke Taylor, the new MP for Sutton and Cheam, he's going to be a London spokesperson. He's really, really made a great start. Bobby Dean, the MP for Carshalton and Wallington, I've asked him to be in the Whip's office because with 72 MPs now, we need to make sure that the Whip's office is working really well, and Bobby will make a fantastic contribution. So that's just the London MPs in our new team.
And what are you hoping to see from your new team?
Well, our job is to be the best opposition in Parliament. And you know, I think the Conservatives are in trouble because, first of all, they haven't got much credibility on many of these issues because they cause the mess, whether it's the economic mess, the financial mess, the rise in taxation, whether it's health and care that they left in the mess. So with the Conservatives having no credibility on these issues, the government needs to be held to account by a party that does, but done in a different way. Conservatives have already reverted to that Yarboo politics that I think turns people off. We're trying to be much more grown up in our approach to opposition by the tone we use, the fact that we're coming with alternatives, not just saying we're against this, but what we're for, how government should do it differently. And I think if we are an opposition across the piece that behaves like that and takes a different approach, I think people will see that we're a better opposition than the Conservatives and hopefully, therefore, keep trusting us.
And you're left with 39 backbench MPs, more than twice the number of Liberal Democrat MPs prior to the election. How does that make you feel?
Well, it's great to have such a large team. I mean, let's remember, we're the largest third party in Parliament for over 100 years. That means our voice can get heard. And it was frustrating the last Parliament because we often didn't get called. For example, I used to get one question to Prime Minister every 5 weeks. Now I get two every week. So one can use that. And all those backbenchers, they'll be playing a big part on select committees. So I'm very keen that those backbenchers really help hold the government to account by playing a big part on select committees. So I'm really delighted we've got the chair of the Health and Social Care Select Committee, one of Parliament's biggest committees, that's Leila Moran, an Oxfordshire MP, and then the select committee that looks at environmental issues, farming, rural affairs, which will be tackling issues like sewage, that's being chaired by Alistair Carmichael, the Liberal Democrat MP for Orkney and Shetland. So those backbenchers, if you like, will have massive roles in the Liberal Democrat effort to make sure this government performs properly.
Moving on to the topic of assisted dying. Now, you voted against assisted dying. What are your concerns?
Yeah, this is an issue I've had to debate and discuss in Parliament and with constituents many times over the years. And it looks like there's going to be another debate in Parliament. And I welcome that. But it's an issue that we don't take party lines on. It's a free vote for MPs, of all parties, because it's an issue of conscience. Now, my position has been a real concern about the impact it can have on many people. And it comes partly from personal experience, to be honest. And I was, when my parents died, I was brought up by my grandparents. And I think there's a real risk that people of an older generation might feel they're a burden on their children, grandchildren. And without being very frank about it, they might well opt for voluntary euthanasia, which would be awful. And, you know, I'm a father, a significantly disabled son. I see great value in his life. And I just worry that while people might be attracted to this, because quite clearly they don't like to see people in pain, that they don't think through all the consequences. And, you know, I looked after my mother when she was dying for 3 years. She was terminally ill. She had bone cancer, which was very painful. And I would administer morphine and various other things. And my view is we need to get palliative care better. We need to get pain relief better. We need to get end-of-life care better. And that's the priority. And I'd rather see that done first before we take this quite traumatic measure of assisted dying.
Why are people even considering assisted dying? Is it because palliative care isn't as good as it should be?
No, to be honest, it's been an issue that's been debated over the years. This is just the next time it's been debated, to be honest. I think there are people of all parties, including my own, who feel very strongly about this, who want to give people the chance to end their life early. And I respect their views. You know, I think I should make this clear. I recognise this is an issue of conscience. There are strong and, I think, valid views held on both sides. I've had many constituents write to me wanting me to support it, right? So I know out there and amongst your listeners, there'll be people who think we should proceed with this. I would just urge people, and obviously particularly MPs who will have to take a decision on this, to reflect really carefully, really, really carefully. I think when you look at some of the evidence, it's not as clear cut as some people think. And I think if you think about what it's like, particularly for elderly people worried about being a burden, if you look at the need to improve our palliative care and pain relief, I think there are this wouldn't be the right step. And I'm going to listen to debate. I'll be very frank with you. I think it's an important debate to have. While you can hear that I do have my views, I think it is important in a matter of this sensitivity and importance that people do listen to the other side. But I will take some persuading.
Now, on to the subject of the winter fuel payments. What is your stance on cuts to the winter fuel payments?
I think the government's got this wrong. I think it's just wrong to take the winter fuel payments away from pensioners. You know, sometimes you read in the press, well, there's lots of pensioners who are wealthy. Well, actually, the vast majority aren't. The vast majority of pensioners in my constituency who won't qualify for pension credit and therefore won't be able to keep their winter fuel allowance, they're still struggling. You know, I've talked to pensioners who are just above the pension credit limit and therefore will lose £200 or £300. And they're really worried as we face winter. They're seeing the energy bills are going to go up. Ofgem says the cap's going to be raised by over 10%. So the cost of living crisis hasn't gone away. And this originally was put in because too many pensioners were really suffering in the cold weather, not putting their heating on. And this the evidence shows this has had a direct impact in encouraging pensioners to feel that they can keep their heating on when it gets very cold. And with energy prices going up, I think we need it. And I think the government says, well, it's all the fault of the last government because they crashed our economy, left our finances in a mess. And I agree with that extent. The Conservatives did make a real mess of our public finances. But I don't think this is the way to clear up that mess. So don't accept the government's argument. We shouldn't be clearing up the mess of the Conservatives on the back of pensioners.
During Prime Minister's questions, you shared a story on a man called Norman who's a carer for his wife, Roz. Now, he's had to go back to work to pay for his wife's care, but that means he's now above the limit for pension credit and they are set to lose their winter fuel allowance. How are you lobbying the government?
Well, I raised Norman's case and that of his wife, Roz, at Prime Minister's questions as part of the Liberal Democrat campaign to persuade the government to change their minds on taking winter fuel payments away. And we're going to continue to work hard on this issue, raising it at every opportunity. We voted against the government's proposal. We've got the budget coming up at the end of this month on the 30th of October. We're going to be working up to that point to try to persuade them to use the budget to change their mind. And the way we're going to do that is looking at Labour MPs, because you know the opposition will, of all parties, I think, will vote against this. But Labour's got a big majority, but there are signs that some of their MPs don't agree with this position. If we can persuade enough of them to make it clear to the government that they would lose another vote, then maybe we can get a change. I'll be frank with you. The government seemed to be quite stubborn on this issue, I regret to say, but we'll keep fighting. And, you know, if they don't get rid of it in the budget, we'll keep on campaigning, because it's just wrong. And I'm just really worried about pensions this winter.
And people in your constituency will be affected by this potential cut. How can you reassure them?
Well, they need to know that their MP is campaigning against it, first of all. That's, I think, the thing they want to hear most of all. What we can do, and I know through the local authority, through voluntary groups, is try to make sure those pensioners who are eligible for pension credit and would therefore keep the winter fuel allowance, but haven't yet applied for it, do know how to apply to it, get help to apply for it. I'm particularly worried that sometimes the government seems to think, you know, if you put a form online on the internet, then it'll be filled in. Well, I'm afraid that's not the case for many people, particularly pensioners who may not have access to the internet. So I think we need to really help people who are eligible to continue to have help, to make sure that they fill in those forms and get the help. But there'll still be many others, I'm afraid, who won't be eligible, but will still struggle. And for them, we've got to really find ways to move the government to take other measures. So, for example, there's a big debate about having what's called a social tariff for the most vulnerable, which will give targeted energy discounts for the more vulnerable people. So I think there are other ways we'll campaign to persuade the government to provide help for people who are in trouble.
You have made a pledge to be a champion for carers. First of all, why is this so important to you?
It's important in several ways. It's important, to be honest, from my own personal experience. I was a carer for my mother when she was terminally ill as a young teenager. Then I did a lot of caring for my lovely Nana, my grandmother, who looked after me after my parents had died. And I care with my wife and my wonderful son, who's got a severe disability. So caring is something I've got a lot of experience of. And we're very fortunate in the terms of we get family support from our family, and we manage it. But there are a number of people who are carers who really struggle. They struggle financially, struggle to hold down a job while they're caring. And I'm really conscious that I need to be a voice for those carers, understanding what they're going through, even if I'm in a fortunate position to manage to keep working while being a carer. So I want to make sure that carers' voices are heard. There's so many millions of carers, family carers, and I just think up to now, the political system has ignored them, and I want to make sure that they're heard.
And as a carer yourself, how important would you say it is to know that someone is fighting your corner?
Yeah, I mean, what's been interesting is as I've occasionally told my story of being a carer, and did it initially with a little bit of nervousness, I'll be honest, and trepidation, because you don't often really want to talk about your old personal circumstances. But so many carers said, thank you for speaking out, and sort of wanted us to continue to speak out. So I've been encouraged by that response from a lot of people, actually, young carers, people looking after their partner who's got dementia, and people looking after disabled children. And so encouraged by those people's responses, I'm determined to keep talking out that they seem to understandably think it's the right thing to do. So I'm going to keep doing it. And what's interesting, the more you look at this issue, the more important you realize it is for the health service and for our economy. I think if we're going to reform the NHS, the best way to reform the NHS to make it more efficient is actually to get the caring side right, whether it's the social care with care professionals in our care homes, going into people's homes to look after them, or family carers. I think if you get care right, you'll sort out the NHS. You'll go a long way to sort it out. And there's the aspect of the economy. You know, there are a lot of people who are caring for family members who could work if we got a few things improved, so they could do the caring and work, and that would help the economy as well as help their own family situation. So I'm the more I've looked at this issue, the more I think it's the right thing to do, and I also think it's the wise thing to do.
Moving on to the NHS, you've been urging the government to make this year the last winter crisis in our NHS. How do you suppose they do that? How do you make the NHS winterproof?
Well, we've called for a task force to be set up urgently to act now, as well as making this budget on the 30th of October a budget for NHS and care, and try to make sure that we just get the planning right. You know, I think people get fed up every year there's a crisis. Why don't they just preempt that? Why don't they organise better ahead of time? I think that's better value for money, frankly. If you plan properly, it ends up costing you less to deal with issues rather than having to spend money at the last minute in a crisis situation. So with our task force proposal, with our proposal to make the budget a budget for the NHS and care, I think it would go the way to make sure this is the last winter crisis. We don't have a crisis in NHS during winter.
You've also urged the Prime Minister to improve cancer urgent referral times in Kingston. Why is that?
Well, not just in Kingston, across the country, to be honest. I'm afraid the Conservatives made such a mess of cancer care that in the last year, which obviously was mostly under Conservatives, there were over 100,000 cancer patients who'd been referred for treatment, but who'd waited over the 62 days target. That's a target that is there to make sure people start getting treatment early, but it wasn't being hit. Now, Kingston, to be fair to Kingston Hospital, is one of the highest performing hospitals in the country. It's a really good hospital, and it's nowhere near as bad as other hospitals. However, even Kingston was missing the target in too many cases. I think it was about 79% of patients in the area were treated within 2 months, with a target of 85%. So that's too many people not getting their cancer treatment quick enough. And so whether it's Kingston or whether it's anywhere else in the country, we've really got to step up to make sure people get cancer treatment quickly.
And why are referral times so bad currently?
Well, if you look at how we turn it around, there's a whole range of things that you need to do. You need to make sure we have enough specialist cancer nurses, dedicated specialists. You need to make sure that some of the technology we've got, like radiotherapy machines, are there. So if you look across the UK, we've got an aging set of radiotherapy machines, and we've got far too few. France has twice as many per capita. And so, you know, whether it's the kit to help the treatment, things like radiotherapy machines or whether it's the specialist nurses, there's an awful lot that can be done to make sure treatment can happen more quickly.
And the final thing I want to touch on is Surbiton Station. What's the latest with the Surbiton Station redevelopment?
Oh, I can't tell you how frustrated I am. You know, we managed to get the second staircase done at Surbiton. That was a great success. It took 10 years of campaigning, but it's reduced dangerous peak time overcrowding, made it quicker to exit the station. So I think people are happy about that. But the frustration has been at completing the work at the rear of Surbiton Station to make sure there's disabled access there, to make sure that the lift at the back of the station can be used by not just disabled people, but people with lots of luggage, elderly people with mobility problems, you know, mothers with pushchairs, fathers with pushchairs. And, you know, we've been working on this for a long time. The money is there. The plans are there. But there just seems to be too many delays. And, you know, I haven't said this publicly before, but I've got very frustrated with both South Western Railway and Kingston Council, because I think they need to work more closely together and more quickly together. They don't seem to realise how important this is. So I've had meetings with them. I've actually emailed both of them this morning because I keep getting excuses and you know, each blaming each other for delays, and that's not good enough. So I'm calling them for a meeting in my office tomorrow. And I'd urge you, if you don't mind, on Radio Jackie, if you would phone SWR and Kingston Council and say, are you going to sort it out? Because the MP has lost patience. Now, obviously, I'll try, but I'd love pressure from the media, too, to back up the work that I'm doing. I've made it clear that I'm taking to this to the media because I've just lost patience with them.
Are you hopeful residents against the plans will still be heard now that Labour's effectively telling councils to push ahead with all new developments?
I'm very worried that the government's taking the wrong approach. There's no doubt we need to crack on and build more homes, particularly affordable homes, particularly council homes. And we need to change the approach of the last government, which was a developer-led approach, which actually led to not enough homes and often the wrong type of homes in the wrong places. We need a new approach. But I don't think that should exclude the local community. And I think people get this wrong. They say, well, people never want housing in their area and there's all NIMBYs and so on. I think that's wrong. Actually, people do want homes, but what they want is to make sure that the infrastructure is there to make sure that those new homes can be welcomed. So, for example, if you're in a community and there's the sewage system isn't working, or you're in a community where there's not enough places for schools, the schools or the GPs are already overrun, you're going to say, well, hold on a minute, we can't have any more home because the current infrastructure, social infrastructure, the physical infrastructure doesn't work now. So you have to take a community approach which makes sure those infrastructure issues are sorted, so that not just the new homes, but the existing residents feel happy that the local infrastructure can cope. And when I talk to people about planning applications, that they're much more willing to accept more homes if there's that infrastructure investment. And that's why I'm slightly worried, or frankly very worried, the new government's approach doesn't seem to take that into account.
And the final question I have is, how can people get councils to listen to them now that so many developments are going forward, despite public consultations overwhelmingly showing no support? For example, we've got Fountain Roundabout was off the table, but now it's back with plans to go ahead as a crossroads when people campaigned against that.
Well, I can really understand people's frustration. I share it. It's part to do with this planning system that's in the planning law, which should be reformed in my view, which essentially allows national government to override what the local council has proposed. So, and indeed forces the local council to take positions that the council doesn't actually want. Because if the council doesn't agree to some development, it'll get referred to the planning inspectorate, and the local council would just be overturned. So the system is a bit too centralized, in my view, very centralized. And I think I can understand why people blame the councils, but actually a lot of the blame should go to central government, who've just got the system wrong, frankly.